Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. History is full of dark periods, eras in which things were done that we don't like to think about. But ignorance of history may condemn us to repeat it. A certain amount of looking at uncomfortable periods can help us learn about our past and about ourselves. And that is part of the reason we're going to revisit a show on a difficult topic today. Our nation's ugly history with lynching. Between 1882 and 1968, nearly 5,000 people were executed by lynching. Most of the victims were African-American boys and men, hanged many times for minor or trumped-up offenses in what often became community events. For years, these racial lynchings in the South were largely undocumented, and the terror this violence caused in the community was never fully examined. In 2018, the Equal Justice Initiative, led by Brian Stevenson, opened a remarkable memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. Part of the Legacy Museum, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, is the first of its kind and memorializes the thousands of lives ended by lynching during this period. Mecklenburg County has two names as part of that memorial, and later in the program we'll hear more about uncovering the two known lynchings that happened here. But first, we revisit our 2012 conversation with Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South. In that book, Dr. Clegg revisits a violent episode in his hometown of Salisbury, one that made headlines in the early 20th century. He joined us along with Dr. Jeffrey Leek, professor of English at UNC Charlotte, and Emily Zimmern, then president of the Levine Museum of the New South. In 2012, when the show originally aired, the museum was hosting the exhibit Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America, based on a book by the same name. I started by asking Emily why this dark period in American history is important to examine.
It is important because it describes a chapter of American and Southern history that profoundly affected American society, and its legacy continues to reverberate today. It changed our country in so many ways, and the lynching period was used as racial intimidation of African Americans. They lost their right to vote here in North Carolina. A new constitution was passed. And for more than half a century until the Civil Rights Movement, they weren't actively involved in the civic arena. And more so, lynching touched people's lives and created enormous fear and was a major motivator in the great migration of African Americans out of the South.
Most of these lynchings occurred in the South, but not all of them occurred in the South, and not all were lynchings of African Americans. There were a number of white people in this.
Absolutely. Lynching has happened throughout history and in all periods, but in this particular period, it was really used as part of white supremacy campaign that looked at African Americans as somehow less than human. And it was an issue of power. It really reached its ascendancy in the election of 1898. After the Civil War, there was a period when African Americans very much participated in civic life, were elected to Congress, were elected officials. And then in the 1890s, there was a really severe economic downturn, and that alliance of called fusionist, where African Americans and less affluent whites had come together and elected many people to office and were changing in many places the face of the South. There was a major reaction against it, and some of the former leaders who didn't like that trend used all sorts of racial intimidation to drive a wedge between that biracial alliance.
As I read through parts of Dr. Clegg's book and listened to you speak, it seems to me that there are some parallels to what's happening today. I don't know whether it's driven by economic downturn, but there are fears of the other around the country.
Well, I think that that always happens in any time of economic distress. That's unfortunately the trend to scapegoat people. And we make no political statements. In fact, we are really inspired by two senators back in 2005, George Allen, Republican of Virginia, and Mary Lou Landrieu of Louisiana, who worked across the aisle because they had been inspired by the Without Sanctuary book, and passed the first resolution condemning lynching in history. I think it's important that our listeners understand how Without Sanctuary came about. An antiques dealer in Atlanta named James Allen would travel flea markets across the South looking for items to sell. And he came across postcards, if you can imagine, of lynchings. I mean, he was so taken aback, he couldn't believe what he was seeing, but he began over 20-plus years to collect these postcards, and there would be horrific images on one side and on the back notes saying, "Dear Uncle Henry."
Dear Mom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and he was so shocked. And so he collected this, and the postcards, or some subset of them, were first shown back, I believe it was 2000, in New York at a gallery with no historic context, and it just created an absolute sensation, because people couldn't believe this had happened in America and not so very long ago.
Why the title Without Sanctuary?
Because the people who were lynched had no haven. There was no safety. They weren't protected by our American system of equal justice under the law. It was mob action outside the system that was to protect all American citizens.
The book, Without Sanctuary, has a foreword written by Congressman John Lewis, who was alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the height of the Civil Rights era and throughout the whole era, actually. And he says, "Many people today, despite the evidence, will not believe such atrocities happened in America not so very long ago." He calls this an American Holocaust. Dr. Leake, is this exhibit incontrovertible evidence that it did in fact happen?
Well, it certainly makes the case in very powerful and provocative and disturbing ways. And, well, you can't argue with the images that are on the postcards for those who would deny that African Americans experienced such brutality at home. And, in fact, Dr. Clegg makes that case, or came to this, and he can explain it far better than I can, mm-hmm. by looking at the book, Without Sanctuary. That was the impetus for
Troubled Ground.
For Troubled Ground.
That is why you wrote Troubled Ground, which is the story about what happened in Salisbury, Dr. Clegg?
That is exactly right. It was while thumbing through the book Without Sanctuary back about a decade or so ago that I came across this image of men who had been lynched in Salisbury in 1906. I grew up in Salisbury during the late 60s and the 70s. I had never heard of any lynching, and certainly not this particular lynching that took place in 1906. So if you might be able to imagine my surprise that, having grown up in this place, I'd never heard of this particular tragedy. But there was, in this book, Without Sanctuary, a full page of this image that had not come to my consciousness during my childhood in Salisbury. And no one with whom I spoke with after seeing the image had seen it as well. So I'd known about lynching. I had been, at the time, I was a history professor, and I taught U.S. history and African-American history, so I knew the history in a sort of general way, but not in a sort of personal way that I came to know it after seeing this image. And so it was a personal journey that I set out on to put the book together, to research this book, and to find out more about what had happened in my hometown. So, the book was absolutely essential to this becoming a much more personal history to me.
What is interesting and what is troubling to me are not just the photographs of people hanging by the neck as the result of crowds stringing them up, but the crowds themselves gathered around these people who are dead or dying and having their picture taken.
Yeah.
Now, lynchings, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, were illegal, but these people who perpetrated these crimes are fully willing to not only have their pictures taken proudly, but printed on postcards and sent around the country through the postal system.
Mm-hmm.
Explain this to me.
I think what we've tried to do at UNC Charlotte with the Center for the Study of the New South is provide a context to explore those kinds of issues and questions. You know, what was moving these people in these communities who, after a lynching, may have before or after a lynching gone to church or been involved in various activities that all of us historically would have participated
in. Some
of
the notes on the backs of not all of these are postcards. Some of them that are postcards, some of the notes on the back of are celebrating this. They're bragging about their being either a participant or a witness to this and what a wonderful day it was.
Right. These are ritual moments. And that's what's scary. That's what's so disconcerting, that it'd be different if it were one or two rogue people just acting very badly. But these are communities gathering together, and the question does arise, what's going on in their minds?
The photographs in this companion book are gruesome. But more troublingly, I think there's that famous statement by a Supreme Court justice saying, I don't know what pornography is, but I'll know it when I see it. This is pornographic material as far as I'm concerned.
That's why the subject has been so enormously taboo. The images of what could be done to the human body it's really tough to look at.
Because some of these people are not just hanging by the neck. They've been, what they call in this book, barbecued. They've been burned alive.
Precisely.
And they have been stripped, some of them.
It is incredibly important, as Congressman Lewis and others have said, to bear witness to these atrocities, to reaffirm the humanity of the victims. These were individuals. They were fathers, sons, uncles, friends. And
there were some women.
And there were women, and there were victims of other races. Mm. So it is very much, whenever atrocities happen in history, we can't turn away because it's ugly, because it's essential to remember that history. And in the sense, as you started out, that it's not forgotten or repeated.
What was the impact of these photographs on the people of the day, the people who were not participants or witnesses to the actual event, but only saw them, only experienced this through photographs? Were these considered snapshots of the truth? Were they considered entertainment? Were they there simply to validate people's innermost thoughts? What was going on in the minds of the viewers of these pictures?
Well, I think all of the above that you have mentioned, and we can't iterate enough the way in which the black body, certainly in the 19th century, first half of the 20th century, is the place where, certainly in the minds of many whites, that's where you act out all of your inhibitions. That's you can do to black bodies what you can't do to anyone else. And you mentioned the term pornography. That has been used to talk about the fascination in the 19th century on the part of whites with slave narratives, for example, because you could read slave narratives and see all kinds of things occurring that you couldn't talk about in polite society. The rape of women, sexual exploitation of women in slave narratives. That where else could you read about something like that? And so with lynchings, you have, again, access to black bodies that you can do anything to. You can act with impunity, and that's what's scary.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Leek, professor of English at UNC Charlotte. We're also talking with Emily Zimmern from the Levine Museum of the New South, and Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South. More of our 2012 conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a dark period in our nation's history when nearly 5,000 people, mostly African Americans, were executed by lynching between 1882 and 1968. Our guests are Dr. Jeffrey Leake, an English professor at UNC Charlotte, historian Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South, and Emily Zimmern, former president of the Levine Museum of the New South. Our conversation was recorded in 2012 when the museum was hosting an exhibit based on a book of photographs documenting this form of racial terror called Without Sanctuary. When we left off, we were discussing the disturbing fact that these incidents were often captured on film. Dr. Clegg weighs in on the use of technology at the time.
Camera technology was fairly new at the turn of the 20th century, the late 1800s, early 1900s. It had been around for decades, but it's still fairly new. And I think that, unlike today where we know that a lot of things can be done in regard to special effects and the things that can be done with cameras and video and the editing, a picture captured a sort of visual truth for people who saw these pictures. That is, it confirmed that something actually happened. And it was unedited, it was raw, it was real time for them, as close to real time as they could get. So a picture of a lynching confirmed that it took place, the fact that people were smiling, grinning, posing, suggest that many of these events were very much choreographed for the camera. People were playing to the camera. I'd imagine that the sort of back and forth dynamic between a crowd and the actual lynchers was fueled by the knowledge that this was going to be captured, there was going to be an image, it was going to be circulated, and people around the country, even around the world, could visually, sort of in a vicarious way, witness the lynching. They witnessed it in miniature, it'd be on a postcard or something like that. So in a sense, it was safe in so far as a postcard is not the same thing as being there or seeing a full mural of a lynching. But I think the camera, the photography, gave lynching a sort of modern veneer as well. This is a modern technology capturing what many would believe to be a sort of pre-modern or barbaric thing and bringing it into the 20th century. So I think that the commentators are exactly right that this is a kind of pornography, but it goes hand in hand with a kind of modernity. The first full-length motion picture this country produces is Birth of a Nation, Birth of a Nation in 1915, I believe, and it has a lynching scene in that film. So that says a lot, I think, in regard to how race and racism are bound up in a sort of modernist vision of what race should be in this country. But at the same time, it shows a desire of people to project onto the images that they see that, you know, this is a visual truth, this is a reality, and that, you know, Uncle Henry or Aunt Sally was actually there because they're in the picture, because they're posing for the camera, because they're smiling. This actually took place, and it is real. And I think that gives it a certain sort of cachet for a lot of people, a certain sort of value, the fact that this is photographed, and again, at that time, anything on film, anything captured by a camera, was actually the real thing to be experienced.
Mike, you ask, how did people respond? There was a whole spectrum of response. There were many anti-lynching advocates and activists who tried desperately to get state and national legislation passed.
There were some children lynched, but far more children, it seems to me, in the crowds. There were a lot of kids watching these lynchings. Why? What would today, I think most parents would be loath to allow that. They only let their children go to the funeral of their grandmother sometimes. Now we're watching a murder take place.
That's what makes them so horrifying in many ways. I mean, I think parents take their children to events that they think are significant.
And that's, to learn something from.
Exactly. And one thing that we do in the exhibition, again, based on the listening sessions we held for over a year, is to ask questions. And one that has proven incredibly moving for visitors is, can you imagine yourself in the picture as a bystander, as the victim, as a member of the mob, as the photographer, or as someone who chose to stay home that day? And it really causes all of us to think about, where do we stand, or where would we have stood?
It really, those images bring home the fact that this is a community endeavor, that it's not just one or two people. It's the community, different aspects of it coming together for, you know, a moment, a ritual moment of violence and brutality. But that's what's so unsettling.
And they're not wearing sheets over their head.
No.
They're in full view of their neighbors.
This is what we do. And then this is how those children you're talking about are socialized.
Right.
So it makes sense that it takes as long as it does for us to advance politically, socially, economically in the 20th century. I mean, it makes Jim Crow, it makes sense that Jim Crow lasted as long as it did.
Dr. Clegg, in your book, Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South, you say that even in the West, which had a fairly well-developed legal system, lynchings were perpetrated by people who believed in more justice and less law. Out West, what were the perpetrators of lynchings trying to address that they felt the law wasn't addressing?
I think that in the period before the Civil War, in many parts of the West, you actually have fairly undeveloped legal systems and small settlements, not much in the way of a court system and ways to legally adjudicate conflict. So people take it into their own hands. Your horse is stolen by a horse thief, and that was really a quick way to get yourself lynched. The sort of the equivalent of stealing someone's car to take their horse is even more significant than that, since the horse could also be used for agricultural labor, transportation, and so forth. Because there was very little in the way of legal recourse in some areas of the West, a lynching served or stood in the place of a legal proceeding, and often those involved in the lynching of, let's say, a horse thief, they would go through the motions of a trial and a sentencing phase and that sort of thing, and then lynch the person. Over time, as more places in the West become less frontier, and there are actually settlements and towns in our legal system, I think you see a less frequent incidence of lynching. It still occurs. And it is still the case that people think that justice is something that needs to be handed down immediately. We don't have time to wait for the sheriff or the trial or jury to be assembled. People think in very local, immediate ways about justice. And that's one way of understanding lynching, not only in the West, but in the South as well. Even in the late 19th century, as we have Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, coming into being. We have a much more elaborative system of criminal justice, appeals courts, and so forth. There are still people who are thinking that's not quite enough. It's not quite enough to wait for justice to run its course, for the defendants in a case to have their own legal representation. We, the community in which this crime took place or this alleged offense took place, are the ones that should be imposing justice. And it should be immediate justice. It should be justice before the eyes of the community, before the eyes of the victim's family. It should be final justice as well.
Taking the law into your own hands. There's a photograph in this book, and I don't know whether it's in the exhibit or not, of Leo Frank. Leo Frank is a Jewish man from Atlanta. Actually, he came from New York, went to Atlanta to run a pencil factory in the early 1900s. There's a whole play about this, a wonderful Broadway musical called Parade. And he is, I think, essentially pardoned at some point for this alleged murder that he committed of a factory worker, which I don't believe he committed. Pardoned by the governor, put in jail for his own protection, brought out of the jail by a crowd, they then lynch him. So these are people who want to take justice into their own hands. The justice system, in this case, they considered to have failed them. What kinds of things were considered crimes worthy of lynchings?
Wow, there's a whole slate of things, really an endless list. It could be arguing about wages. It could be talking back to a white person. It could be joining a labor union. It could be accused of staring, gazing, speaking to a white woman. It could be wrong place at the wrong time. Certainly a charge of murder, assault, rape of a white individual could get you lynched as well. And then again, there were instances in which it wasn't necessarily the case that an individual person had been accused of some crime. So it wasn't a question about individual guilt or innocence, but the larger lesson that an individual lynching was communicating to the larger community of whites and blacks.
So would the majority of these alleged offenses not have been enough for the legal system to react, and therefore you knew that the legal system couldn't or wouldn't do anything, so by gosh, you will? Is that what was going on here?
One of the pieces in the exhibition that I think has really touched visitors is we have on a panel, and I'm looking at them. I mean, there are probably 24 or more offenses, and we ask the visitors, have you ever done one of these, or do you know someone who's done these? I mean, and there are things, vagrancy, which at the time means simply not having a job, theft, gambling, insults. I'm trying to look at some that quarreling, just simply having an argument, at times self-defense. I mean, there's a list of all of these. It's not simply that you're being put to death because you killed someone. And often it wasn't. I mean, it might simply be...
Well, if you're having a quarrel, it was obviously a quarrel, but at least in these incidences where an African-American is being lynched, was it a quarrel between a white person and a black person?
Dr. Clegg can reference a dispute, I believe, in the case in Salisbury that happened long before any lynching. Isn't that right, Dr. Clegg?
That's exactly right. It was a quarrel over wages between black sharecroppers and their employer. That is as simple as that. A quarrel over how much each side of the equation, employer and employee, would get from sharecropping, which ends up in a lynching. But also there's a charge of murder against those individuals who are involved in the dispute. That is, the black sharecroppers accused of murdering this white family. But that was actionable cause. That is, if you were in a dispute with a white person, it was assumed that the white person was being the truthful party, the black person was the party that was being insolent, unreasonable, and so forth. So as minor, in our view, certainly a thing as that could get you in some deep trouble.
Now, Congressman Lewis, who writes the foreword to the Without Sanctuary book, says investigators frequently found no easily ascertainable reason for these lynchings, except perhaps white emotional and recreational starvation. Bill from Matthews writes, I recently became aware of the lynchings of two blacks that occurred in my hometown of southern Indiana, not too far from Bloomington. It took place in the early 20th century as a result of a miners' strike. The two victims were hanged from the marquee of a local movie theater. To my knowledge, no photos of this event exist, but it raises the question for me, what is known about the backgrounds of the people who took the images that are on display? Were they photojournalists, Klans? Sympathizers, bystanders? What do you think was the motivation for taking these photographs? This is before iPhones, where everybody is carrying around the camera in their pocket. If you had a camera, you were most likely to go, what, a professional photographer? I don't know.
Dr. Clegg?
I would say a camera was a pretty precious commodity in the early 20th century. It was very unlike today, where any of us can bear witness with a cell phone camera or a camcorder or an iPhone or whatever. They were very expensive, one. Secondly, you couldn't just snap a picture, in a moment's time. You had to set up the camera. It had to be very still. You had to have usually some covering over the head of the camera operator. So as not to, overexpose the film. You couldn't develop it there on the spot, of course. So the images of lynchings were are images that took some time to actually set up. People had to be still so that it wouldn't blur. Motion blur was very easily something that would occur if people moved. So to see a picture of a lynching meant that usually a professional, a person, one who could afford a camera, two, could operate a camera, was there on the spot, was there ahead of time. I almost knew what was going to happen, had been called upon to take images of this event. So it wasn't a case that you sort of chance took a picture at a lynching, or the camera guy just sort of chanced upon a lynching. These were very much choreographed, and again, people were taking these pictures are almost always professionals, and again, work with a newspaper or some other organization that could afford a camera and a person who could operate it.
So where was the law in all this? Was law enforcement a complicit bystander in all this? Were they in agreement with what was going on? Were they simply incompetent? Did they lack the knowledge that this? Were they afraid of coming up against the crowds who were their neighbors and friends in some cases? What was the story about with law enforcement and all this, if lynchings were illegal, which they were?
Well, I think
all of the above. Oh, go ahead.
No, exactly. I think all of the above, and Dr. Clegg talks about that even in his book about how even in Salisbury, when attempts were made to protect black men who were accused of certain things, the mob won out, and that's the dilemma that we found ourselves in, and it's this. And you can find this in African American literature, the way you were talking about how they choreographed, or how Dr. Clegg was talking about how lynchings were choreographed and staged, and time was put into the images that were eventually produced. That's why, certainly in the literature of black men in the 20th century, in the fiction of black men, you find elaborate depictions of these kinds of moments. And for many black characters, lynching is the coming to the awareness of the possibility of lynching is a ritual moment. Mm. You have to be told certain things when you become of age so that you can hopefully survive. Lynching in particular produces a certain kind of fear, and that's what it's used for, because you could kill someone, you know, in a more standard way, but whites understood that lynching had a certain power and sent certain messages to whites and blacks that we're going to maintain the racial order.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Leek, professor of English at UNC Charlotte. We're also talking with Emily Zimmern from the Levine Museum of the New South, and Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South. More of our 2012 conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our 2012 conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Leek from UNC Charlotte, Emily Zimmern from the Levine Museum of the New South, and historian Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South. Because these lynchings went on for a couple of hundred years, I asked Dr. Clegg what finally made them stop.
I think a number of things are going on in the 20th century in particular that don't necessarily end lynching, because there's still a stray lynching now and then. There was one in 1998 in Texas where a man named James Byrd was dragged behind a truck to his death, which was a popular style of lynching even in the early 20th century. So occasionally, even at this late date, there's still rumors, and not necessarily just rumors, but actual episodes within our lifetimes, within the last couple of decades, in which a style of murder that's reminiscent of lynching comes to our attention. But I think what's happening is that the South in particular is becoming a less parochial place, a place that's under the scrutiny of the rest of the country. The South is trying to attract capital and investment and industry, and capital wants stability. That is, those who are going to invest want stability. They want to know that if they're going to set up three or shop or invest in some facility in a town, that a lynch mob is not going to tear through the place and burn up things or chase off workers or give the company a bad name. So, one, I think that the region is opening up in a way that lynching makes it look particularly bad. And the resistance to it is mostly a top-down resistance. It's governors, it's business people, it's journalists who turn on this first. And again, I think there are some humanitarian, certainly, motives here. But it's also an image motive, and it's also an economic motive. So there's a kind of southern boosterism, wanting to present the place or the region in its best light, again, to attract business, to attract capital and so forth to develop a region of the country that had been historically underdeveloped. And lynching was cast as something that was not something the New South should be involved in.
Well, this uptick in lynchings, and you talk about this in your book, coincided with the populist movement of the 1890s, which led to the disenfranchisement of African Americans. They couldn't vote anymore. They couldn't hold office anymore. The rise of the poll tax coincided with this. Literacy tests became ways to keep people from voting. Other means to limit African American participation in political life were in place. And with all these limits in place, why were lynchings necessary? Why was there an uptick in all of this?
This is a holistic approach to race relations. That is, lynching is piece of a larger assault, a multi-pronged assault in regard to structuring race relations in a way that protected white privilege and white prerogative. That is, keeping people from voting is a way of ordering the political cards, keeping people segregated in systems, exploitative systems, sharecropping and debt peonage, etc. But there were still people who resisted even those things. And what do you do with the person who insists upon voting or the person who insists upon arguing with their employer over their wages as a sharecropper? What do you do with the person who won't sit at the back of the train or comes into the restaurant anyway, even though there's a sign that says for whites only? Lynching was that last line in which people were clearly designated, that is, you belong and you don't belong, or this is what we're prepared to do to protect white privilege and prerogative. And this is your place. If you cross this line, you could be killed. How better to demonstrate the power of white supremacy and white privilege, how better to demonstrate black powerlessness and subordination than to make it a life and death situation or life and death proposition? So lynching dramatized more than anything else white power and black powerlessness and the lengths that people would go to protect that. And again, the fact that law enforcement officials and others would allow lynchings to take place oftentimes, I think says something about the power of this particular mechanism of white supremacy to run roughshod even over the law itself. So I think lynching is part of a larger configuration or larger mechanisms for configuring race relations, and it's that last line. If you insist upon voting, if you insist upon arguing with your employer, if you insist upon X, Y, and Z, this could happen to you, and it will happen publicly, and it will be a lesson to the rest of the community as well.
That's Dr. Claude Clegg, author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South. We also spoke with Dr. Jeffrey Leake from UNC Charlotte and Emily Zimmern from Levine Museum of the New South. Our conversation was recorded in 2012. More recently, Mecklenburg County has worked to uncover the story behind two documented lynchings here. Two African-American men, Joe McNeely and Willie McDaniel, were killed in separate incidents in the early part of the 20th century. Their names are memorialized with over 4,000 others at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a first-of-its-kind memorial dedicated to victims of white supremacy, founded by the Equal Justice Initiative's Brian Stevenson. The Levine Museum of the New South has continued dialogue about the legacy of lynching, and last year I spoke with staff historian Dr. Willie Griffin and community historian Michael Moore about that legacy. I started by asking Dr. Griffin why we gloss over this part of our history.
I think this country, I mean, we like to tell stories that are not so hard to and heavy. We like to think of this country as being on a progressive
track,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so
are we? You're the historian. Are we now, or have we ever been?
I think we are on a progressive track. I mean, it's just how we discuss history. I think one of the things that encouraged Brian Stevenson to start this national dialogue was visiting other countries like Germany, Rwanda, and South Africa, where he's seen these national dialogues actually change the way that we interact with people.
A lot of times these, not always, but a lot of times these lynchings took place in the public square. Thousands of people attended. All the town folks turned out, including children, to watch these events. And it was kind of like going to the races or a football game. It was a party.
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
It was a seller.
And postcards floated around the country of these pictures.
The fact that they were held in very public spaces, they were celebrations. They were meant to bring people into an arena to show them that black people were less than. African Americans were less than. They would sometimes leave these bodies hanging for days. People would take souvenirs, take chunks of skin out of people, take out their eyeballs, genitals. So these things were meant to really celebrate and really terrorize the African American community. As you mentioned, postcards were sent all across the country. We just recently had an author in, Dr. Seth Koch from the American Studies at UNC, and he talked about if an African American happened to have left the South on the Great Migration, it's very possible that they could be in Massachusetts somewhere and see a postcard to remind them of the lynchings, the kinds of things that they were seeking to escape.
You say that an understanding of lynching and what led to it is enormously important because there are ongoing ramifications of it today. What are they?
Well, part of the reason that Bryan Stevenson started the Equal Justice Initiative was he wanted to explore the roots of mass incarceration and excessive punishment through an examination of this evolution of racial terror lynching. I think that if you look at the statistics that show who actually populates the American jails, the courts, there's a direct link to African Americans being overly targeted for lynching.
Just the same mindset at work?
I think the same mindset. It's evolved. It's evolved a little bit. But I think if you look at popular culture and the way that we look at African Americans who commit crimes versus other races, there's this tendency to say that we have to penalize them a little more because they don't understand. They won't learn.
It's the same. It's the same legacy. It's the same legacy of slavery. And this notion of white supremacy and of black dangerousness, black criminality, especially among African-American men. When we tell the story of the two local victims, Joe McNeely and Willie McDaniel, we also provide a context for how this story, that the notion of white supremacy and how it's played out and how it relates to mass incarceration today, we provide that context in Charlotte. We show that Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, two out of five residents of Mecklenburg County on the eve of the Civil War, were enslaved.
Right.
We show how, despite fighting for the rights that the federal government provided them, most of those rights were lost in the white supremacy campaign of 1900.
Yeah.
The white supremacy clubs in Charlotte were created in a meeting in the mayor's office in City Hall. And then the parade that led the Election Day party of several thousand people through the streets of Charlotte was led on horseback by the chief of police. You have a system that is treating black people as less deserving than white people.
I think you also have to talk about the emergence of the convict leasing system that we don't normally talk about.
The chain gangs. Where they built the roads.
They built the roads.
Mecklenburg County, evidently, was notorious for its chain gangs. How so?
Well, it was the first county in the state to have a permanent chain gang in 1885. And it's actually what led to the torture of two African-Americans, young African-Americans, by the name of Woodrow Wilson Shropshire and Robert Barnes in the winter of 1935. They were tortured in one of these chain gang camps. And it actually led to the shutting down of chain gang camps all across the state.
Now let's talk about how you get on a chain gang.
Right.
Yeah,
because as you say, these people were leased out to build roads and do other things where the state profits and you don't, and certainly the workers didn't. What did you have to do to be sentenced to a chain gang?
In North Carolina, in Mecklenburg County, if you were convicted of any crime, chances are you were going to end up on the chain gang.
Give me an example.
Woodrow Wilson Shropshire in the winter of 1935 was committed of disorderly conduct.
Disorderly conduct.
He got in a fight, public fight. So he goes to the chain gang. He gets disciplined for warming himself by a fire against, you know, without permission of the guard.
Right.
He is sent into solitary confinement and chained standing up in a cold room for 9 days.
And if you tried to escape these, you may have been there for a minor infraction or what was perceived to be an infraction.
Right.
Sometimes it was trumped up. Mm-hmm. But if you tried to escape, lethal force was used.
That's correct, yeah.
It's interesting that actually Joe McNeely, the 1913 lynching victim in Charlotte, who was taken from his hospital room at Good Samaritan Hospital, located where
Bank of America Stadium is.
Panther Stadium is today, and shot by a by a mob of as many as 75 people. His older brother, Jim McNeely, was sentenced to the prison camps and was working on the chain gang for stealing chickens. But he was shot and killed escaping the prison camp, his older brother. So he was in there for a misdemeanor. He was committing another misdemeanor, and he was shot and killed without consequence. And
I think it's also important to make this link. You asked how could what kind of crime could get someone, sentenced to a chain gang. You have to make this link from the end of slavery, the vagrancy laws that emerged with the Black Codes. If you did not have a job, it wasn't uncommon for a local sheriff to scoop you up and really rent you out to a local farm. And so these became sort of the forerunners of chain gangs. Mm-hmm. So these laws that often got African Americans into these chain gangs came out of the Black Codes.
It was slavery part
yeah.
two,
yeah.
essentially.
It was a revelation to discover how central the prison camps and the chain gangs were to the criminal justice system. 90% of the convicts on the chain gangs in Mecklenburg right. County were African American.
So when were the chain gangs at their height?
They were the main source, the main part of the penal system from the beginning of the 20th century wow. into the 1950s.
In North Carolina from 1880 to late 1930s. By World War II, because of this international conflict, many southern states, and particularly the president became very aware that this would look bad on an international stage. So you begin to see slowly states throughout the South begin to discontinue these chain gangs.
The height of lynching evidently occurred in the 1880s and mm-hmm. 1890s. The two Mecklenburg County lynchings that you've referenced occurred in the 20th century. Joe McNeely, I think, was in 1913. He was shot. He wasn't hung. He was shot by a crowd who dragged him out of the hospital. And then Willie McDaniel, who was found hanging from a tree in 1929.
Well, he wasn't actually found hanging from a tree. There was evidence that he had been hung from a tree, but he had been drugged to an adjoining property to try to conceal the actual crime.
Well, that was 1929. How many more attempts or successful attempts at lynching were there, either in Mecklenburg County or North Carolina, later on in the 20s? When did they stop that we know of?
The last one in North Carolina was in 1946.
And there were often efforts to try to lynch African Americans. There were numerous efforts before the turn of the 20th century in the 1890s where crowds tried to storm prisons or jails, local jails, and tried to bust a supposed criminal out to lynch him.
And most of the targets were African American men, but there were women.
Locally here in Gastonia, Ella Mae Wiggins, she was in the same year, 1929, the same year as Willie McDaniel. She was an organizer, a labor organizer, trying to bring blacks and whites together under labor unions. And she was targeted and really killed by a mob extrajudiciously.
Do you think that these incidences of racial terror, these lynchings, the chain gangs, are easier for most contemporary people to understand than perhaps why some people want to see Confederate monuments taken away? Do they see the injustice more clearly when it involves human beings who were murdered essentially by mobs?
I think so.
In 1929, Willie McDaniel was lynched. Mm-hmm. 1929 was also the summer that the United Confederate Veterans held their reunion in Charlotte. The same summer. And
do you see a connection there?
Yes. The reason I brought that up is because a memorial was built on public land as part of that event in the summer of 1929, and it still stands there. And what it says, among other things, is that they preserved the Anglo-Saxon civilization of the South and became the master builders in a reunited country.
That's community historian Michael Moore, along with Dr. Willie Griffin, staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Our conversation was recorded last year. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.